Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. It's the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this day after Christmas, and I hope you have a moment to sit and read today or sometime this weekend. You know, one of the great benefits of being the host of this program is I get to read great books all the time and talk to the authors about something I just read.
When I heard about this story of a convenience store clerk, a Muslim immigrant from Bangladesh, shot by a white supremacist, and then the immigrant 10 years later forgives his attacker, the deeper I got into this story, which kind of just intrigued me, I realized that it was a collision between these two Americas.
New York Times columnist Anand Giridharadas talking about his revelatory book, The True American, this year on The Takeaway.
What I did feel was the fear, because they were always watching what they had to say.
Mm.
Always. There was not a moment that was free.
And there's author Suki Kim talking about her journey into North Korea to write the book Without You, There Is No Us, a grippingly real portrait of the young men who are being groomed to be the next leaders in Pyongyang.
In the military, we say that the commander is responsible for everything his unit does or fails to do. I was a commander in both Iraq and Afghanistan. I was a general officer commanding in both countries, and we failed in our mission.
And here was the very confessional three-star general Dan Bolger talking about why we lost in his book of the same name about Iraq and Afghanistan. All three great reads this year, and their authors appeared on The Takeaway. Next up, an author who tells a completely unusual story about Iraq and Afghanistan through the eyes of three women soldiers. Writer Helen Thorpe wrote Soldier Girls as a counterpoint to the very male stories of lone survivors and snipers published and turned into movies. Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War is an amazing read. We missed Helen on her book tour, but invited her to speak about a book that really rocked our understanding of women in war.
For a long time, women were restricted to support positions. And, you know, sometimes when we think of war stories or we're reading a book about war or watching a movie about war, it's very focused on actual combat. And so if women are excluded from those particular jobs, you have this funny result where their stories don't get told.
The three women that you choose to focus on here, do you think you can generalize from these three, or are they very, very special? You certainly got three very special stories here.
You can generalize in certain ways, and in certain ways you can't. So all three women are in the National Guard, and I think you would find very different stories in different branches of the military. The National Guard, they're toggling back and forth between civilian lives and military lives. So that's kind of unique. Generationally, there's a big spread. The youngest is 21 when she first deploys, and the oldest is 52. So there's 30 years difference in age from youngest to oldest. And there's that much difference in their political beliefs. So they have really different points of view on the conflicts that they're serving in. And in that way, I think it would be hard to generalize. The single mom with three children, Desma, she's recently voted for Bush right before she deploys. And she supports the war in Afghanistan, but she's not sure about the war in Iraq. And Debbie, who's the oldest, she's a beautician when she's not a soldier. She supports both wars. The one who's opposed to the two wars, she's a college student. She's the most liberal of the three. And yet, I do think you can generalize about their experiences as women. I mean, all three of them get a lot of comments all of the time from the men around them who are really interested in, you know, propositioning them from dawn till dusk. So in that sense, I think their experiences are very particularly female, and you could generalize about them.
What surprised you most about their reactions, even given the differences that you've cited between the three characters?
Sometimes I was surprised by these small little mundane details that they would share. Michelle, the youngest, who really had never, ever intended to become a full-time soldier and was not the kind of person who would have enlisted post 9/11. You know, when her deployment came, she was really troubled by the act of putting on this uniform, which she felt was very male. The clothing itself didn't feel like what she would wear as a woman. And so she ended up, you know, buying fancy underwear from Victoria's Secret online to sort of make herself feel better. I mean, that sort of, it's a funny little weird detail and not what you sort of think about when you think about life in a war zone. And yet for her, that was a real big part of her reality, that she didn't get to wear her own clothing every day and she didn't feel like herself. Just on a sort of bigger, maybe more important note, I didn't really understand as a civilian that today we were routinely deploying single mothers with young school-aged children. But we are. I mean, in an all-volunteer military, some of the people who sign up are women with children. And if they get a divorce or something like that, they can easily wind up as single parents. And they get deployment orders just like anybody else. Single men single fathers are getting deployed as well. And I think part of what I ended up looking at was the impact on children in these circumstances, because in previous conflicts, when we did have a draft, we didn't draft people with young children. It was considered unacceptable to send parents with young children off to war. But today we do.
What do you think this story, Soldier Girls, tells us about America generally? It's certainly a story about three women, but, you know, it's a very interesting window on America at war.
I think the book offers a real snapshot of their lives and their economic circumstances at the point when they enlist. And I think you see a real decline in the fortunes of their families and all the people around them, their relatives. You see, in the case of Michelle, the young college student, you know, her parents losing factory jobs, having a hard time finding work, signing up for the military is the only way she can think of to try to live the American dream. So you're watching a whole region in economic decline, and you're watching the most resilient people in that setting turn to the military as a way out, a lifeline. And you see them return to people who don't really understand their experiences because they've done these overseas deployments that are so hard to explain to everybody back home. So what you see is a huge economic divide between the type of people who serve in the military and then civilians at home who don't necessarily understand what veterans live through. And there's just a ever-widening gulf, it feels like, between civilian society and veterans.
Well, Helen Thorpe, if people this holiday season spend time looking over the shoulder of Brad Cooper in the Sniper movie, watching him pull the trigger as a window on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, they could probably get a much better snapshot of what it was like and what it is like in those conflicts by reading Soldier Girls. Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Helen Thorpe is author of Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. Another great read that I can't end this year without mentioning is the book In the Kingdom of Ice by Hampton Sides. The full title is In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. It's a tragedy and a uniquely American story that has faded from history, but was one of the biggest stories of 1879, 1880, and 1881, rivaling even the assassination of a president, James Garfield, in 1881. The ill-fated USS Jeannette was commanded by Captain George Washington DeLong and crewed by an odd collection of characters who, it turns out, Hampton Sides says, were all decent writers.
There's just this amazing trove of a very good primary material. So that's mainly what the book's based on. But I wanted to go to Siberia and go to the Bering Strait and kind of get a feel, at least a glimpse of what they went through. I think it's really important when you can to physically go to the places that you're writing about.
You certainly, in reading this book, get a sense of just the isolation and hopelessness. I mean, I woke up at night dreaming about some of the scenes that you described. They were so evocative.
Yeah.
Did you feel a chill? I mean, a literal, beyond simply the weather, a chill?
Yes.
From walking in the footsteps of Captain DeLong and Mr. Melville?
Well, yes. There's something about the Arctic. As bleak as it might seem, there's some sort of grandeur and majesty to being in a place where no one has ever been before. It's also a landscape that appeals to certain kinds of people, and they keep coming back for more.
Could you get a sense of the deprivation they must have experienced? I mean, you describe, you know, eating your shoes. I mean, the extent to which they, you know, suffered from physical ailments of one kind or another in the course of being on that ice for 2 years. Could you feel that being out there, or is that almost impossible to imagine?
Well, I do think it's impossible for me. Certainly when I went, I was in the comfort of a nice warm Russian icebreaker with decent food on board, and I don't want to pretend that I understand what these guys went through. The one thing that is similar, though, and it's something that grabbed me was, you know, I had this notion that once you're stuck in the ice, you're kind of stuck in this monolithic slab, and there it is. You're kind of imprisoned, and it's nice and quiet, and nothing could be further from the truth. When you're in that ice pack, the ice is constantly shaking and shuddering and shrieking, making all these terrible noises, fascinating noises if you're on board an icebreaker because you're not worried. But you know, from DeLong's point of view, for those 2 years when they were drifting, they were constantly warring with the ice, and it made for this very unsettling period. You know, they wanted to relax. They wanted to essentially just get through this drift, but they're constantly fighting the ice.
Among the most evocative scenes in your book, In the Kingdom of Ice, are the celebrations that the crew has on Christmas and New Year in the ship, at least in one case. What did they do? How did they organize their celebrations to keep their morale up?
So they did have these feasts and festivals and musicals. They had a theater. They had a library with state-of-the-art collection of books. They had classroom situations that they got into, you know, like seminars that were taught by some of the officers. They got out on the ice every day and exercised and even played football games and went on these amazing hunting forays. They proved to be very successful at hunting for polar bear and seal and walrus. But that 2 years of drift, you know, did finally weigh on them, and there was some bouts of insanity and some behavior near the end before the ship sinks. As you can imagine, being in the Arctic for that long, it drives people crazy.
What did this whole journey on your part leave you with as a journalist?
Well, on one level, it is a tragic story. It is a tragedy in the sense that they didn't reach the North Pole, and many of them died in the process of trying to make their way home. But I focused primarily on what happened after that ship sank and how DeLong had to pull together his very few belongings, three open boats, his 33 men and his 40 dogs, and to try to make it to safety in time before winter set in. And what you had is a 1,000-mile trek across the ice trying to reach the nearest landmass, which was the central Arctic coast of Siberia. To me, this trek across the ice, the way he held the men together, is really the focal point of the story, and it's not a tragic story at all. He makes it all the way to open water. He keeps the men together. They ultimately set sail for in open water towards the Arctic coast. And I think had they not encountered this massive gale on the second day, I think they all would have landed together and all would have survived, and this would have been considered really, along with Shackleton, the famous Shackleton endurance story, it would be considered one of the great survival stories of all time. As it is, 13 of the 33 make it home, and I don't talk about precisely who and how and why, but the rest of the book is about how those men made it to safety.
Well, it is certainly a survival story and a test of human endurance on so many levels. Hampton Sides is the author of In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. One of the great reads of 2014. Hampton, thanks so much.
A pleasure being with you.
Coming up, more books, authors, and recommendations for your reading pleasure right here on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We want to tell you about some other good reads you may have missed in 2014 unless you were present at the Brooklyn Book Festival. Producer Mithili Rao sat down with three novelists at a panel called Brooklyn Bound. There's a long tradition of writing about Brooklyn. Walt Whitman's poem Crossing Brooklyn Ferry is an ode to the future that is inscribed for all time at the Brooklyn waterfront. These three authors, Yelena Akhtyarkaya, Mark Chisano, and Jason Reynolds, each turn their gaze on a different neighborhood. Brighton Beach, Marine Park, and the more familiar Bedford-Stuyvesant, the scene of a police shooting last week and the emotional fallout from that tragedy, which has enveloped all of New York. When Jason Reynolds spoke about his neighborhood, though, and its sense of place, it was months before the police shooting. Bed-Stuy, he says, still has its rules and unstated codes of the street.
You know, I always talk about codes, right? The sort of the term codes and social coding. And what I mean by that is that in certain neighborhoods, and actually in all neighborhoods, there are social codes that everyone sort of knows, whether they're spoken or unspoken, we all sort of know, right? If I'm in some neighborhoods, I'll you turn your music down, right, if I'm in a car, right? But if I'm in my neighborhood, you turn your music up when you're in the car, right? It just sort of depends on what the neighborhood psyche is. And so I think that in this particular story, the young people in the story are influenced simply by the codes of the community. For instance, loyalty. And in most communities of color all around the country, right, loyalty is one of those strange, really, really weird things because people really hold dear to it almost to a fault. I mean, people really sort of cling to each other and cleave to each other. If I'm your friend, I'm your friend. If you're my brother, you're my brother. Even when you're wrong, I'm going down with you, which we all know is oftentimes a terrible, terrible thing. But that's sort of what the community codes are oftentimes. Whether we understand them or not, that's just the way it goes. Family. Family's a big deal. In most of these communities, family is all you really have. And what that family looks like isn't always a nuclear family. It isn't always sort of dad at home and so forth and so on, even though it also isn't always dad's not home. And it isn't always, or it's not always dad is home or dad's not home and dad's not around. Sometimes it's dad's not home and dad's around, right? Or dad loves me, he just doesn't live here. Or, you know, mom's not around and dad's here. Or big brother's taking care of me. All these different sort of dynamics, I think, in these communities are what sort of strengthen these kids in this way and help and have them act the way they do, right? They are a little older than they seem, yet they're still kids. And they look to each other as family. They look to each other for loyalty. They try to trust each other. They want to protect each other. It's all about sort of maintaining a particular unit while moving throughout this sort of neighborhood, whether you're on the good side or the bad side or on this street or that street. We're moving as a unit at all times. And that is a very sort of... not just a Bed-Stuy thing, but just from, I grew up in a black neighborhood in D.C. It's just from what I know, and I lived in Detroit. I mean, communities of color in general, that's typically how they operate for whatever reason.
Yelena, that reminds me of your little family unit in Brighton Beach, and they have a kind of code, but it's very much their own little unit, and they kind of look after each other very intensely, and they are a world unto themselves. I almost felt like there's their house, and then everyone else is a little bit in the backdrop in the neighborhood. I mean, how does that square with your own experience?
Well, I guess there's a lot of similarity between Russian people and, you know, black people. Also, the music is very loud, but that, to me, is just painful. I just, please turn the music down in the car. But... my family in particular is just like this, you know, intense clan. It's like, it's very, very intense. But I think that that's also generally immigrants, you know. Any sort of immigrant community, whether it's Russian, Jewish, Chinese, I mean, anything. You come and then you hole up in your apartment. You know, usually it's too many people and too small of an apartment, and you just let your neuroses, like, you know, entangle you in the craziest, you know, possible little thing in the world, which is like love mixed with every other emotion in the world. So that's, I feel like I understand that.
And, I mean, it's the case for some folks in your story, too. I mean, there's one particular story in this husband and wife couple who are almost straight out of a mafia movie.
Vincent Aurora.
Yeah.
I mean, it's totally true that all these, this is one of the things about Brooklyn, I guess, is that there's these neighborhoods that have these extremely strong characters. And the sad bit is that often these are racial divides, and even more often those divides aren't really bridged. What's funny is that the one major characteristic about Marine Park is probably that it's not changing, or it really hasn't changed in a long time. And if it does, it'll be a slow-moving tectonic plate. In the summer, lots of people bike to the beach now, which is also a recent thing in Brooklyn. But for some reason, I guess it's a Google Maps thing, the street that Google Maps tells you to bike, you know, on the way to Flatbush Avenue to go over the bridge to get to Rockaway is now 35th or 34th Street or something. And there's just hordes of fixed gears going through Marine Park, you know, on 30-something Street. I haven't seen it, but I can imagine everyone from Marine Park going, what are these things?
I'm purposely moving to Marine Park. I'm going to start the process.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Start working that out.
Yeah. But, like, not on your fixed gear.
The importance of a sense of place in life and writing. Writer is Mark Chiazzano, author of Marine Park Stories, Yelena Akhtyorskaya, author of Panic in a Suitcase, and Jason Reynolds, author of When I Was the Greatest. Head over to thetakeaway.org for audio of the full event moderated by Takeaway producer Maithili Rao. And all this hour, we're sharing your book recommendations. Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Ian Hartman from Fairlawn, New Jersey. I recently finished reading a book called Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, about black revolutionary workers in the late 70s. It's a fascinating look about our class and race in America and about how race has been used to divide workers. Very, very good book.
This is Lindsay from Rochester. I read Wild by Cheryl Strayed. What an amazing journey.
Hey, this is Danny Simon from West Bloomfield, Michigan. I loved Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch so much that it had me going back to find everything else that she ever wrote.
What book did you read that you want to recommend? We're at facebook.com/thetakeaway. More next.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2014? Huh? Stumped you. Gotcha there. You're going, the French guy, right? Google it. French novelist Patrick Modiano. And Googling it is exactly what Carolyn Kellogg had to do when we asked her about Mr. Modiano moments after he was named. Kellogg writes about books for the Los Angeles Times, and she's vice president of the National Book Critics Circle.
He was ranked by Ladbrokes, which is a betting house in England, at like sixth going into the final stretch.
Well.
But he's much better known in France and in Europe than he is here. He has been mostly published by small independent or academic presses. And he isn't one of those hipster authors like Nausgaard,
right.
Although he seems to write like sort of mini Nausgaard-y books.
And in terms of the Nobel, why do you think he qualifies, if you do, as a Nobel author? I mean, there are a lot of obscure authors who made it to the Nobel. In many ways, it seemed as though the committee was trying to resurrect the backlist or acknowledge someone for preserving a language or a culture, that sort of thing.
A lot of times the Nobel Committee is motivated by a sense of social responsibility. So the winners are people like Toni Morrison, who are wrestling with big moral issues like the legacy of slavery. So it seems, from the little bit I know of Patrick Modiano, that what he's doing is looking at the closely examined life and memory, and some of that memory has to do with the legacy of World War II in France.
Well, let's talk a little bit about who didn't get the award. DeLillo, Cormac McCarthy, among the Americans. Joyce Carol Oates, who is prodigious as well as a skilled writer. Philip Roth has always talked about.
Yeah, I think of all those writers, Philip Roth is the one who people tend to think, oh, he should have it coming. But one of the judges of the Swedish Academy said very clearly that he thinks that Western literature is suffering from professionalism, from a lack of intellectual rigor. And so if he continues to be a big force on the judging committee, I think that Philip Roth has a long wait.
The Nobel Committee doesn't consider popular literature to be the kind of literature that they care about. They're definitely looking for some other set of qualities. And I'm looking at some of the other strong contenders, at least in terms of people trying to predict what the committee would do. Haruki Murakami, Ngugi Wa Thiong. These are people who are writing very much in the tradition of some of the other writers not terribly well known in the West.
That's true. I think it's interesting, though, that if you look back at the past when they did acknowledge American writers, that some of them, like Hemingway, wrote very accessibly and were big bestsellers. And Faulkner, although he's known for his like intellectual novels, he also wrote pulp novels. So the high and the low sometimes come together in a single author's work.
Well, lots of diversity in literature, and you know that's part of what the Nobel Committee is celebrating here. And we celebrated along with them the winner of the 2014 Nobel Prize for Literature, French novelist Patrick Modiano. Carolyn Kellogg writes about books for the Los Angeles Times. She's also vice president of the National Book Critics Circle. Carolyn, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. I got to go read some Patrick Modiano now.
I bet you do. Modiano's titles are marginally more available today, but many are still on back order in English. But give it a shot. Better time spent than watching football this weekend.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Earlier this year, The Strand magazine published a forgotten and virtually unknown short story of John Steinbeck called With Your Wings, the story of a black man learning to fly and lifting his family and every other black man in America up into the sky with him. It was read by Orson Welles on his radio variety show in July of 1944, a recording that's lost to history. Andrew Gooley, managing editor of The Strand magazine, found the story, though, With Your Wings, while combing through the University of Texas library. And here's the first line. He knew most of all that he wanted to go home, that there was something at home he had to get, and he didn't even know what it was.
John Steinbeck was a writer who had always tried to speak out for people who are marginalized. And this was a time where African-American soldiers were not treated very well. They were not allowed to worship in the same chapels. They were separated in their eating quarters. So Steinbeck was, I think, trying to give a very, very powerful message how most African Americans had looked at World War II as part of their fight and part of something that they needed to contribute to the United States. And this might have been a faint cry saying that perhaps the U.S. Army and a lot of states should have passed laws to treat these people better.
So I read this twice, Andrew. The first time I read it through, it was this very emotional, wow, what a moment for an African-American to come home and to be recognized by his family as having achieved this milestone, the gold bars on his shoulders. And then I read it a second time, and I thought to myself, all right, from the African-American's perspective, this could be seen as a very over-sentimentalized view of what was going on at the time. How do you see that?
A part of me did agree that at the end, perhaps it was over-sentimentalized. But then I stepped back a little and I said to myself, let's take things in their context. And the United States in 1944, I don't know if the radio listeners were ready to hear something that was quite hard-hitting about how African Americans were segregated in the army. And I think that this was John Steinbeck's way of trying to show something in a sentimentalized way with a hope that that would bring some understanding among people who were perhaps bigoted, people who are not as progressive as he was.
You know, I'm looking at this great line, which is the big reveal. The father says to the son, son, every black man in the world is going to fly with your wings. I wonder, you know, there could be a lot of lines there, you know.
You know, that's a great point. The reason I think Steinbeck has resonated with people for the past 70 years is that he's able to have everybody, all his readers, walk inside the shoes of another person, be it an impoverished farmer in the Dust Bowl or a young African-American soldier who's trying to come to the terms with the fact that he's feeling a huge weight of expectations on his shoulders and a lot of pressure. Feeling that you're an outlier, you're one of the first people who is marching head on into something that's unknown.
Well, there's definitely a feeling of pressure, but it's very much a sense of pure pride, almost as though there will be time later
or the worries about how you'll be treated in the air, or how you'll have to be an example and you'll have to be perfect, and that if you weren't the best pilot in the world, that everyone's going to be bringing you down. The sense of having to be sort of the Jackie Robinson, you know, which comes in the next decade. This story really gives us that.
Exactly. And John Steinbeck of the 1940s was a different John Steinbeck from the 1950s and 60s, in that he came to see the United States as a country where excess was killing us, where a lot of he'd hoped that the civil rights movement would progress quicker than it had progressed.
Well, with the exception of the war in Iraq, it's you know, very profound to see that Steinbeck spans this whole period of American history and so much change. And in this little simple story, we can see so much of 20th century U.S. history. Now, you need to get yourself along back into the library to find another one of these gems so that we can talk again.
Well, you have about two more that I can promise you will be coming out next year.
Well, that's fabulous to hear. Andrew Gooley, managing editor of The Strand Magazine, thanks so much.
Thanks, Don. Always fun chatting with you.
Another Nobel Literary Prize winner left us this year. Nadine Gordimer died in July, an event that hit me quite hard, as I've admired her books for all of my adult life. This is how we commemorated her passing on the program last summer. You know, it seems as though I have always been reading the words of Nadine Gordimer. She died over the weekend at age 90. South Africa's first Nobel Prize winner for literature. I was reading her words yesterday tearfully as the thunder rumbled over a rainy New York City, evoking the endless African vistas she always described. The rainy places, the dry places, all the dignified faces, the proper young girl eyes bursting with life, staring down authority. The mouths resolute with power and grace. She wrote of the determination of the oppressed to be free, of the struggle to free herself from the prison of being a white woman in South Africa. Raised by South Africa's strict race rules as a young girl, she became part of the activist mixed race crowd as a college student when she started out as a writer.
Journalists, actors, people who in the arts who normally indeed don't follow the rules, the conservative rules, and where the feeling about the incredible distortions of racism, not only the oppression of blacks, but the distortions in your personality, in your mind as a white. These became very much part of my life and indeed started my way to freedom.
Nadine Gordimer speaking shortly after winning the Nobel Prize for Literature. You can hear that radiant, almost thermonuclear frailty as she speaks. My next guest and I share two details. Until Sunday, our entire lives were spent in a world where Nadine Gordimer lived. In this conversation, though, our second shared detail, it will take place entirely in a world where she's no longer with us. Zeke Mda, South African novelist and creative writing professor at Ohio University, joins me now. It is a pleasure to meet and speak with you, Zeke.
Well, it's my pleasure, John.
I think Nadine Gordimer is probably one of the most relevant writers who ever wrote, in that she was always writing about something that was happening, tangible change right now.
Oh, certainly. You know, she was one of the most relevant writers in South Africa. And we are very, very, very sad that she left us.
How did you experience her growing up?
Well, you know, she was a staple. We read her work, even though some of her books were banned, but we continued to read them underground. You know, you could go to jail for reading some of her works. It was a crime because there was strict censorship in South Africa those days.
What was your impression of her bravery reaching across this boundary?
Oh, well, we admired her. That is why amongst us, even to this day, you know, we refer to her as Comrade Nadine. And of course, as we grew up, you know, she mentored a number of us, black writers, and we got to know her personally, and she became a friend, and we worked with her. We traveled the world with her, and we basked in her fame and in her generosity. She was a great person, not just a great writer, but a wonderful, wonderful human being as well.
What did she teach you?
First and foremost, of course, you know, generosity was one of the main things because, you know, she didn't talk about it. She lived it. She shared herself. For instance, after she won that Nobel Prize, most of that money she plowed back into developing black writers in South Africa. So she was a very generous, a very compassionate person.
I was reading your work and her work last night, and I was struck by the opening lines of your novel, Way of Dying, and the beginning of one of her stories, the moment before the gun went off. And both scenes are about funerals where the people who are mourning are struggling to understand how external political forces will impose meaning on these deaths. In one case, blacks, in the other case, whites. And the poor people are just so overwhelmed by the politics that are determining their relationships with their loved ones. It was astounding, the intersection between those two scenes.
Well, of course, you see, ours was a culture of death, you know, a culture of funerals. So I'm sure even that story, I would expect, you know, there would be those funerals and so on because, you know, we lived in a world of death and funerals. And it was through funerals, in fact, that we celebrated life. It was through funerals that we expressed ourselves politically, especially during the period when political expression through other means was banned. So it would be at the funeral that people would express themselves. That is why then you find that in our literature, in our stories, funerals would feature a lot.
What do you think she says to the people of today?
Well, you know, she was a very honest person. During apartheid, she joined the liberation movement, and she did not only write about the oppression and the freedom of the oppressed people. She actually participated in the freedom struggle. She, as a person, not just as a writer. After we achieved the freedom, she continued as a member of the ANC, which is the ruling party. But when the ANC or its leadership began, for instance, to show, you know, some weaknesses here and there, we began to see some corruption in its ranks and so on, he did not hesitate, you know, to be critical of his of her own. She did not hesitate to be critical of her own comrades. So, you know, she was very outspoken. That is another lesson that we learned from her.
Zeke Smeda, South African novelist and creative writing professor at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. Zeke, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Finally this hour, a look back at a project we launched over this past summer. We chose some summer reads, all fiction, asked you to nominate a real-life book club to talk about our selections. Author Joshua Ferris' latest novel kicked off that series. The novel is To Rise Again at a Decent Hour and tells the story of Paul C. O'Rourke, a lonely, miserable, but of course successful New York dentist. Instead of a god, he worships the Boston Red Sox until he gets hacked, like Sony did this year, and loses his identity, which sets him off on a spiritual journey. To Rise Again at a Decent Hour was a great pick for the book club, the Portland Gentlemen's Club. Their members include Tim Sands, Max Wall, and John Loheis.
For me, I think, you know, I think the narrator is just trying to find his place in the world. You know, he's a pretty successful dentist, and outwardly he's got all the signs of success. You know, he's got a nice place in New York, and he's got money to go out and grab great meals. But at the same time, yeah, he's just a lonely guy. He can't relate to anyone in one of the busiest cities of the world.
You know, and John, one thing that hit me too is that it's almost like he has his wheel of life, but he's trying to find one spoke to carry the entire wheel. And it's that kind of searching throughout, whether it's looking at religion or his, you know, his iPhone, his me machine, what's going to carry him through life. And he keeps trying to find some sense of community, at least was my takeaway, I guess, that by the end of the book, by joining with this other kind of religious non-religion, but he's still able to have that sense of community, that sense of togetherness, and meeting with people, talking about things, and a group to be together with. And in a way, it made me think a lot of our book club. This is our way of having fellowship and community and meeting with each other. So the notion of finding commonality with other people, even if it's through fraudulent websites, it worked for me.
Yeah, it wasn't so much about the religion for me. It was just another way that he was able to develop his own sort of sense of identity and self and kind of find, you know, again, find his place in the world.
Well, you know, he finds the religious experience in the oddest places. I want you to just know that there's a member of your club now from Grand Prairie, Texas, and this is this person's reaction. The book really pointed out how separated we are in spite of the great number of people on the earth. Interesting how people want to be a part of something larger than themselves, just what you were talking about, whether it is the Amalekites, a fan group, or an internet group. People sure are disconnected despite always being connected to their me machines.
Yeah, and I think that theme was one thing that jumped out at me right away, really just the satire and emphasizing how flimsy technology is as a way to connect, you know, that somebody was able to steal his identity by just going online, starting a website, and all of a sudden that person is Paul C. O'Rourke, you know, and so how kind of flimsy that technology is for establishing those sorts of contacts. There was a lot of emphasis on that point, and it's very true, and it's something we're the first generation to have to try to navigate is how do you work that sort of flimsy technology in a way that you actually get something foundational and something real in community? And that's not a resolved question, I think, at this point.
No, no.
And so it was an interesting thing to bring up in the book.
One thing I noticed with what Tim was talking about was, at least with the advent of things like Facebook, I've noticed that I'm having more communication with people, but it's of a more shallow nature. You know, we're having quick text message conversations. We're not having lengthy discussions. I've started trying to write more real letters in an attempt to try and see if I can deepen my conversations. It made me think a lot of there's a guy named Bo Lozoff who started the Human Kindness Foundation. One thing that Mr. Lozoff really professed was that the answers are the deep and simple. The problem is that the world that we're living in is shallow and complex. And that kept coming back to me as I was reading the book, that he's living in this world that is so one thing to the next, second after second after second. And what he really needed was deep, simple connections with people.
And yet each time he tries that, you know, he messes it up. And it's almost hard to read, especially in the first part of the book, because every time he gets into a relationship, it's just like, oh, come on, Paul. Like, you want him to do better, and yet he doesn't repeatedly.
And you know, one thing I noticed, John, you know, when I was reading through this, there's a section where he starts defining himself not as Paul, but as Paul who loves Connie, all in dashes, all one word. And I actually, this is the first book in a while that I've had to stop several times and think about what I'm reading because it was causing me to think so much about myself and be introspective, which is a little unusual for me. And that once he's in love, he loses his sense of self, and that takes away from your partner whatever they had to love about you in the first place. It's like they're looking into a mirror. And I can think of at least one relationship that I've ruined that way. And so for me, it was kind of a, oh, yeah, moment, and like, oh, well, I need to make sure I don't do that again.
Here's a woman listener from Normandy Park, Washington, Gina Howell Forbes. I found the book to be a fascinating character study of a psychologically troubled middle-aged man. I loved his growth and his increasing understanding of himself throughout the story. I spent a good deal of time wondering what psychiatric diagnosis could be applied to him. I did a little of that. And what sorts of treatment might benefit him. I did not like the ending of the book at all. I felt I wasted the time I'd spent reading the book when I got to the end and nothing was resolved and nothing really changed for him. I'm hoping that by listening and reading the discussion, I can figure out what I missed. Can you help Jenna here?
What I felt was so hopeful at the end is that he has realized that he doesn't have to be this person that he's stuck being anymore. You know, he can go. He's still going to do the charity work in Kathmandu, and he's able to help people out. He's able to have a human interaction with these children at the end, and he's able to just give it a go and try hitting the ball in cricket. You know, I'm flipping ahead here, but he says when he realizes that he doesn't have to root for the Red Sox, he can root for the Cubs because they're even more of a failure.
He loves suffering. Yep.
That's the religious point. I mean, is rooting for the Cubs a religious, spiritual upgrade from rooting for the Red Sox? Does it involve more faith?
I think it depends upon what your faith is based on. If your faith is based on, yay, we're the top, you know, you go root for the Yankees. But all good Americans hate the Yankees, so I think that the Cubs.
Not controversial at all.
If you're rooting for the Cubs, you're rooting because you want. I mean, you want to be like Job. You want to put up with all of the suffering because at the end of the day, if that's what brings you joy. But it's the notion of, he said, you know, the world knew again, something to desperately want. I went inside, and when I came back out, it was on my head, where my Red Sox hat had been for years. And he swings at the cricket bat, and he says, what the hell, I thought, what the hell, and without any expectation or understanding, doubtful of any hope of success, I swung, one eye on the ball and one eye toward heaven. And to me, that says, whether it's baseball or cricket, you take your chances, and you may have doubts, but you still take your chances at the end of the day. And by actually moving forward and doing something and not just thinking about his superstitions, he is able to, I think, begin to overcome those superstitions and begin to still have doubts, but to move forward in his life. And that, to me, was why it was so uplifting.
Tim Sands, Max Wall, and John Lohuis, good friends of The Takeaway now, of the Portland Gentlemen's Club. And we want to thank all the book clubs who participated in our Takeaway Book Club series. You're telling us this hour about the books that stood out to you this year. We got this text from Grand Prairie, Texas. Station 11, beautifully written, powerful book, so powerful it threw me into apocalypse planning mode. I now own 8 empty plastic containers and an earthquake survival kit. Sigh, hoping there's a sequel. Here's to the books that terrify us and move us.
This is Lloyd from the Baltimore, Maryland area. The most incredible book I read this year so far, Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. It drew me into its amazing world, and it made me think and feel very deeply.
Your suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Catch up on that conversation, listen back to anything on the program. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. And thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.